So under specification, collinearity, and proxy variables all lead us to a discussion about searching for the model with multiple regression. The common question is, what is the best multiple regression model for this criterion? There's two versions of this question. There's the descriptive version, and there's the predictive version. The descriptive version is what we mean. What variables are and aren't part of understanding this criterion so I can build a theory and I can engage in practice? The predictive version is much simpler because you're not trying to describe anything. You're just trying to get the biggest R square you can so you can get the best Y prime you can. You don't care what it describes. What you want is accuracy and efficiency, and you pack it up and you go home. But the descriptive side, where most of us will live our lives, is way more important. This certainly seems like an important question because such a model would tell us what variables must be considered to predict or perhaps understand the criterion, and what variables can be safely ignored in our theory and practice. That's a lot of what we're trying to do, is to figure out what we can safely ignore. Because that's how we simplify the world and make it manageable. It's a very weird paradox. The way that we get attention in this business is by pointing out how complicated things are. By showing that if you add these predictors, it increases the fit of the model. That if I look at this interaction, I understand what's going on better. If I take this context into account, if I take this history into account, if I take this culture or gender or something else into account, the way we get attention is by complexifying things. I love that word. I don't think it's a real word. But the way we get things done is by simplifying them, by figuring out what we can safely ignore. So, the model for years and years, and when I was trained and when I trained many of your older brothers and sisters, the definition of the model had two parts. And you have to be careful because sometimes it still does. We're like right on the edge of rogue rampage here. Every predictor in the model contributes to the model. Sometimes called parsimony, sometimes called necessity. Sure doesn't sound like a bad idea. No other predictor would contribute to the model if it were added. It's hard to argue about that. And that sounds good. And if you had a model where everything in it contributes and nothing would contribute if it were added, what more can you ask for? The rest of it. Remember collinearity. We're not trying to understand just what variables matter. We're interested in how they matter. We're not trying to build a model of predictors with significant regression weights. We don't need an R-square. We need the regression weights. The regression weight for that variable has to really tell us about how that variable contributes. And that's where the last one comes from, which people have been pushing for about 20 years. And is so freaking annoying that the resistance to it is unbelievable. It is. It's annoying. No other predictor, if added to the model, would change the structure of the model. In other words, no other variable, if added to the model, would change your idea about what variables are important and what variables are unimportant. No other variable, if added to the model, would change whether it has a positive or a negative contribution. Holy shit, Batman. Do you see the huge increase in requirement? Because there's probably only one model that is going to satisfy that third criterion, and it is certainly going to violate that one. Because what happens as you add predictors? The more predictors you add, the more they all have to share, and the less likely anyone is to have a unique contribution. You with me? Okay. I'm a big fan of this, because it reminds us that we have rejected the critical experiment. And if we rejected the critical experiment, I'm one of those folks who believes that the next thing you reject is the notion of the one true model. You should expect the model to differ. Here's why. Cultural psychology, different cultures have different relationships among variables, right? This doesn't make anybody crazy. Well, let's take it down a step. What defines a culture? Do personality variables define a culture? Does the response to stimuli define a culture? Now it sounds like we're talking about individual differences. And if we expect big individual differences to produce different models, why don't we expect little individual differences to produce different models? So who you have in the study and who they are changes the results you get. That's the same thing as saying any of the variables that capture the differences between them change the model that you get. How are we doing? So all we need is a model with all the variables in it. Now there's the flip side of this. And I'm sorry, I wanted to give you all of that in one page. There are four things that thwart our attempts to find the model. Collinearity, alternative models that perform equally well. That's annoying. Which one has the variables in it that you have to care about? Underspecification, the hockey problem. Also, again, because of collinearity, it's possible to include a variable in the model that, while it doesn't contribute to the model, does change the size or even the sign of the other predictors in the model. So the more parsimonious model might not be the most accurate. And then there's always sampling variability. So these are the things that argue against or push around our attempt to come up with the model. And so what are we to do? Rather than telling the model, we need to tell the story. How the predictors are correlated with the criterion, how they're correlated to each other. Each predictor's contribution to a full model. That's our best shot at what all the variables that need to be looked at are. Different people are going to have different full models. The relative utility of the alternative models. Building a story of which predictors contribute to what models when included in them. Ask a little differently? No, really, what do we do? Concerns about underspecification, proxies, and modeling are all well and good, but we have to actually get a model once in a while. When you go and you collect all those data, you're not going to then say, well, I didn't publish because, you know, Cal made me all cynical one day. Much as we fret about and include in the discussion sections of our article an admission of the procedural limitations of our research, we need to fret about and admit to the measurement and modeling limitations of our research. This is another example of the importance of replication and convergence. So remember and worry about these things, but don't let that worry be debilitating. Work with the best variables in the data that you have, test hypotheses, build models, interpret them, and expect to be wrong. Oh, wait, that's how science works. You'll be fine. But you have to be worrying about these things. Don't let it become debilitating. That's too easy. All right, quick example of a multiple regression model. Here were our predictors from last time. We decided to use the analytic because it had the highest correlation. This time we're going to plug them all in. When we plug them all in, we get about 58% of the variance, which is wildly significant. P's less than 0.001, which means when we say that this model works better than chance, we have a 1 in 1,000 chance of being wrong. I'd like to live a life of choices that have only a 1 in 1,000 chance of being wrong. The next question we ask is, which variables contribute to the model? Program does not contribute to the model. The analytic subscore of the GRE does contribute to the model. Damn, that's a little regression weight. That negative 0.03 means we're going to move that decimal 3 points to the left, which means that regression weight is 0.006749. How can that possibly be worth anything? Well, first of all, we know it's different than zero, because the error in the estimate of that regression weight's even smaller. Second of all, we know why that number is so damn small. We're taking not one, but three scores that have standard deviations of 100. And we're trying to mush those down to predict something that has a standard deviation of less than one. Scale differences. Remember, regression weights represent a mix of, and we're going to do this in more detail on Wednesday, represent a mix of how related that variable is to the criterion, how related that variable is to other variables, and scale differences. If you want to know how much that variable has to contribute, in a relative sense, you look at the beta. Big old honking healthy happy beta here. Quantitative GRE, even smaller, darn near as important, and every bit is likely to really be there. Verbal, a little bit smaller, still wildly significant. 1 in 1,000 chance of being wrong when we say that variable contributes to the model. Does anybody notice anything about the verbal subscale of the GRE? It's negative. Up here, it was positively correlated. Down here, it's a negative contributor. That's what's known as a suppressor. That means something really cool is going on. There's something about the way these variables come together that flips that regression weight. Let's talk about what it means. This simple correlation says that when verbal subscore on the GRE goes up, we expect first year GPA to go up. Right? This one means, giving the usual interpretive statement backwards for emphasis, after you've taken program, analytic, and quantitative GRE into account, once you've taken all that into account, then as verbal scores go up, we expect GPA to go down. Which means, while the verbal subscore of the GE is positively correlated to GPA, it's negatively correlated to the part of GPA that's not program, analytic, or quantitative. Now we'll talk about suppressor variables and where they come from and what to do about them, but I wanted you to see one right off. This is real data, by the way, from this program. Suppressor variables are a pain in the ass, but when you figure out what's going on, often they are the coolest single piece of information. Most of the time, I'm going to get a little anthropomorphic here, but you're used to that by now. Most of the time, a suppressor effect is trying to tell you that you're missing something. Either that you're missing variables that are in the model, and so when somebody's trying to cover for that defender, they're behaving in ways that they normally wouldn't. Okay? Or they're trying to tell you that what you need is a path model because you've got some really cool indirect effect going on, and we can't tease out direct and indirect effects in a single regression. Or it's trying to tell you that you're missing an interaction. Okay? Because suppressor effects are almost always the hockey problem. Somebody's in timeout. Everybody else is trying to make up for it, and some of them are acting differently than they normally would. I also want to remind you that when you get all done, here's a write-up, when you get all done and you build that regression model and use it, we were talking about using this to predict GPA and taking those people that have a predicted GPA bigger than 3.5 and not taking those that's less than 3.5. And so this 3.57 is going to be embraced. This 3.53 is going to be embraced. This 3.49 is going to be hucked into the abyss, which is failure to get into graduate school. That's a little harsh. How confident are we? Well, you want to remember that as long and big a dance as we would engage in, with an R-square of almost 0.6. On average, when we predict, we're going to miss by 0.4. Don't get cocky. All right, if you would be so kind, we'll do this R-square of 1 and less than 1 another time. It's essentially an attempt to give you hope and caution about what R-squares mean, and also to take you a little bit into the land of underspecification. What I'd like you to do is homework 2. Go do something to celebrate Martin Luther King Day on Monday, and I'll see you Wednesday. Homework on the corner of the table, please.